trying to.
Good afternoon. It is about 1:35 on the 19th. And today we have President Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Tilton, Representative Graham Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton, Co-Chair Foster. Today, before we start, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we'll hear from the Department of Revenue on the fall 2017 revenue forecast. Commissioner Fisher, Director Alper, and Chief Economist Stickle, would you please come to the table and go ahead and present yourself on the record, and we can go ahead and proceed. Since there's male voices, if there's if you're answering a question and we're trading from one person to another, please at least state your first name. You don't have to do the whole introduction.
Welcome. Thank you for having us. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the commissioner from the Department of Revenue, and I'm here with Dan Stickle, our chief economist. I'll let him put himself on the record.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, chief economist with the Alaska Department of Revenue.
We're delighted to be here. Before I begin, I just want to note that this presentation is shorter than the last presentation we gave to you, by about half. And we heard from people in both chambers, actually, that they felt like we got maybe too far down in the weeds, and so we tried to shorten the presentation, make it more appropriate for this kind of setting. But I say that both to relieve you but also to signal that if there's a slide that we have removed that you really liked and would like to see, let us know. We probably have it, and if we don't have it, we can certainly update it and prepare it for you. I'm on slide two of the presentation, and I want to just put this, our current forecast, into context. Traditionally, we have a fall forecast and a spring forecast. So we issue the fall forecast in December. We typically issue the spring forecast in April. And so annually we have those two data points. This year, just I think because of the importance of the revenue forecast in all of the discussions that the legislature is engaging upon, we have two other forecasts. We had an early spring forecast, and then after that we came back with a revised spring forecast, which increased some assumptions around production, and we'll show some of those differences. And then, of course, with special session last fall, we issued a preliminary fall forecast in October to help inform that discussion. And as we signaled at the time, that was a preliminary forecast, and we expected there to be some changes between that preliminary forecast and the final forecast, and we'll try to call those out. That's where we're at, reviewing the fall forecast that we issued in December of this year. We will come out with a spring forecast. While we traditionally release that in April, we're working to be able to release that in March, primarily just because we think that that's information that will be important to the legislature and to you as you consider the budget and the various matters you have in front of you. And there are a couple of things that I'll call out in my presentation that I think will highlight some of the importance associated with that. The first section is to just at a very high level review the production forecast. As I think we have explained before, the production forecast is a product from the Department of Natural Resources. And this has not changed from what we issued in the fall, or the preliminary that we issued associated with special session, that preliminary fall forecast. But I think it's useful for people to see and just understand kind of where we're at. And so at a very macro level, from the beginning, you can see that we're about a quarter of the overall production. It has declined. That dotted line to the right side of the chart, on the left side of the dotted line is the actuals, on the right side is the forecast. And what you're seeing is that, as many of you have noted, as we're all appreciative, there has been a couple of years of increasing production, which is different than we had originally expected. And as you look forward, you see that pink slice at the to the far right are new fields that are coming on, which will continue to flatten the production curve and allow us to enjoy a more flat expectation around production going forward. I'm on slide five now of the presentation, and this again is a product from the Department of Natural Resources. The official forecast is the solid blue line in the middle, and it is the expectation of the 50% likelihood of what will be achieved. And as you can see, there's a low case and a high case at the extremes. The low case being that we have a 90% confidence that production will be at or above that level, and the high case represents a 10% confidence level, and so you can see the variability between those.
And before you go on, Representative Guttenberg, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had this conversation yesterday. I'll try to be succinct, and if it's on what we're doing right now. So we have taken over forecasting. We used to been done out of department. Now the state's doing it. You're doing it with Natural Resource DNR. Are you tracking accuracy both in short term and long term to see how you're doing and doing adjustments, and how good are you doing based upon your projections on accuracy?
Through the chair, to be honest with you, I don't know that I can speak for DNR in terms of how they are tracking their accuracy. I'll show you in a moment a slide that reflects the revision from the spring forecast, and you'll see that our current forecast has moved materially from that. And so I think if DNR were here, they would acknowledge that they have refined their process and made improvements to try to improve the accuracy of it and to reflect what the lessons learned from prior experience. But I would be uncomfortable trying to represent more
just
than that.
Just a brief follow through, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Right. So which part of the forecasting do you do that DNR doesn't do?
Through the chair, we take their production forecast, and the rest of the forecast comes out of the Department of Revenue. Okay,
thank you.
And before you go forward, I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Pruitt.
Great. Thank you. Moving to slide six, then, this is the production forecast, and this is what I alluded to just a moment ago.
Just a minute. Yeah, quickly. Going back to that slide four, just quickly, even though it says it's pink and it says new fields, that's known. I mean, that's pretty solid production. We know that production will be there.
Through the chair, yes. So, again, I'm speaking about the work that DNR did, but in the fall when they presented, what they explained was that there's different fields that are at different levels of confidence, and they, in essence, predict production, and there are some fields that have actually, they're known, but are actually not in the forecast because they don't have a high enough degree of confidence to be included. And then these fields are ones that they have a reasonable degree of confidence, they feel like they can predict, and then they kind of discount it based on a risk. And so even within these fields that are in the forecast, depending on where they're located, some of the factors around that field, they may discount it versus what the developer themselves might be expecting, and they come up with a forecast that is their best guess for, well, it's their 50% estimate of what will happen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oops. So on slide six, this refers a little bit to what I was speaking with Representative Guttenberg. In the spring, the kind of burnt orange line at the bottom of the chart was the original spring forecast from the Department of Natural Resources. The gray line represents a revised spring forecast, and that is the difference between, I referred earlier to our spring forecast and our revised spring forecast. This is the difference. It was a difference in the production forecast, and you can see that it declined at a reduced rate. And then the blue line is the current forecast. And so again, you can see that it we're largely flat. And in addition, you can see that the delta between the lines grows wider the wider out you go. And so one of the things you will notice when you examine OMB's budget is that the state's fiscal challenges get less over time. This is in part associated with the assumption that we're going to have increased production. And it's less impactful, the deltas are less impactful in the next year or two, although they're still meaningful.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I know this is a forecast, but we should be done with the spring forecast. How does the spring forecast compare to what actually happened?
The spring quarter forecast was too low. I mean, we were predicting a decline, and we actually enjoyed an increase. And as you can see, we're forecasting another increase in 18, where the spring forecast would have predicted a decline.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is there any way, and I know I'm the one who asked for less slides, could you add that line in this slide and just send it to so we could see in a different color just for the 2017 so we could just see how close, you know, was it just, you know, you were, you know, it would just be nice to know whether we're off a little bit or a lot. It could even be by numbers. It doesn't necessarily have to be a slide, but just to have that other part of the comparison. Thank you.
I guess.
It would be just for 2017, not the rest, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the blue line is at current history, that's the point at which we're departing from.
So I guess I'm really asking for just 2017. What was the forecast for 2017, and what was the actuals for 2017?
Okay, well,
just so we know the difference of how close we were, if we were way off and we're basing our budget still as our primary source, it would be nice to know whether we were just a little bit off so or a lot.
We, through the chair, we'll get that information for you. But to kind of address the last point you made, with each revision of our budget, we address any deltas between actual and forecast so that at this point, the budgets that we are releasing are catching up to those changes, just so you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Guerra.
Thank you. Commissioner, I think you would probably rather us ask questions about which fields are doing better than we expected to DNR than you, right?
I would. Yep. I would struggle to answer those questions.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. Now we're going to move on to the price forecast. And, you know, to go a little bit to Representative Guttenberg's questions about do we learn from our mistakes? Are we improving? I mean, this is a place, candidly, where our forecast, I undershot because we talked about it a lot, and ultimately I made the decision, and we'll talk about kind of what we were looking at then and why we thought the forecast was where we predicted. And candidly, the market moved in a way that we didn't anticipate. Most of the analysts didn't anticipate either. That's my excuse, I guess. But there's some room here, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Looking back, this kind of shows for the last couple of years what's been happening in price. You can see that the average price over the period was $52. Now, here is one place where maybe there is a delta, and to refer to Representative Wilson's question a little bit, our forecast for FY15 is $56. We predicted that this forecast assumes that oil will be at $56 on average during FY18. At this point in time, The average price of oil as of today for fiscal year 18 has been just over $58. So there is a couple of dollars delta. And to put that a little bit in perspective, that a $1 change in price in this range is somewhere between $30 and $40 million of revenue to the state. So you're talking $75, $80 million of revenue if that price holds through the rest of 18, just to kind of give you a little perspective. Kind of looking forward, this is a chart that's produced by the Energy Information Agency from the federal government. That yellow line in the middle to the left of that line represents actuals. To the right of that line represents forecasts. And what you see there is that at the bottom, these green bars, if they're above the line, then that means inventories are growing. If the green bar goes up, if the green bar goes below that solid, the zero line, that means that inventories are shrinking. And so as you look back over the last four quarters, we've had largely shrinking inventories, and that is at least in part of what has been driving the price increase. EIA anticipates, looking forward, that inventories will be growing. And of course, this will be one of the primary drivers in terms of expectations around pricing, again, looking forward. This is a chart that you may have seen in the past. It represents the exercise that we go through in the fall, and in the same way that the Department of Natural Resources has a P50, which is the forecast, and then a range of scenarios with different probabilities associated with it, we do a similar exercise around pricing. And so in the fall, we examine pricing and develop that P50 row in that chart. But we did make some changes between the fall forecast, that fall preliminary forecast, and our final forecast, and that is represented by the red boxes that you see on the page. And so we increased our FY18 budget by a couple of dollars. FY19, that kind of sat between the P50 and the P60, the 50%, 60% line, we took to 57, and then we took the FY20 to and beyond, we went back to the P50 that you see there. But as I alluded to a moment ago, the market has gone higher, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the next few slides. The next two slides are kind of different time frames of the same information, and let me just explain. This is Brent oil. This is Brent crude, which is kind of the international crude market on the seas. It's the other big benchmark that people use is the West Texas Intermediary, but we think Brent is a better proxy, at least currently, for North Slope oil. And in fact, this week they're within a few cents of each other in terms of pricing. Blue line represents Wall Street analysts' expectations, and this is something that we gather up all of the analysts' presentation and take an average of that. The red line represents the futures market, and so it's always interesting to me that that there's as much difference between analyst predictions and the futures market as there is, but you can see that there. And then the green line represents EIA. That's the federal government's estimate of oil prices. And I do want to note that you see there that there's a big jump. And that doesn't actually reflect an increase in their forecast. What it is they have a somewhat dated long-term forecast, and then they issue short-term forecasts underneath it. And we kind of, in order to get a long-term forecast from them and to show it to you, we kind of marry those two. And the steep curve is kind of the jump between their more current short-term forecast and then their longer-term forecast. They will or that we at least expect them to update that long-term forecast in February. And so by the time we come back in the spring, we will have the benefit of their long-term forecast as well. Again, this is what we saw in November as we were presenting to you last time. And as you can see, our forecast was more or less in the range of between EIA and analysts, a little below the futures market. This is based on today, and I'm on slide 12 now. And what you see there is everyone's moved higher. We haven't because we haven't updated our forecast, but the analysts as well as EIA have moved higher, and then the futures market has moved higher as well. But the other interesting fact, at least to me, is that that is a short-term phenomenon. On a long-term basis, the market, the forecast in the market still tend to be forecasting pricing more in the $60 long-term range, even a little bit below this. The futures market is materially below that. And our forecast, as you go out long-term in real dollars, and these are real dollars on this page as well. In real dollars, we assume that the oil forecast will, or the pricing will stabilize around $60 a barrel, and we think we're fairly consistent with other analysts in that prediction. So the takeaway from this is that there's some good news upside, at least in the near term. I think we've probably been a little conservative in our pricing, and we will revise that and share that with you when we come back with our spring forecast.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner, could you talk briefly about the benefits that the state gets from doing our own forecasting as opposed to just relying on futures or the analysis?
Through the chair, that's a great question, and we're actually having that debate actually internally. In other words, is there a benefit to doing our own forecast, or should we choose one of these, or should we average something, and is there a different way that we should be approaching this? I will say that when we do our forecast, we don't do it in a vacuum. We try to bring in, and let me give you a little bit of a sense. It's an all-day forecasting session that happens in the fall. We gather together both within the state but also within the larger community, a set of people that economists and others that have experience and we think have some expertise, and then we bring in third parties that also have some expertise in this area and try to gather the information and then develop a forecast around it. I think historically we felt like the department has felt like that's an appropriate approach that has served us well, and we're kind of asking that question: is this, are we doing it in the right way? Is there do we feel good about the product? Let us get through that process. And I think when we come back the next time, we'll be able to talk to you about what we think is the appropriate way to complete the forecast process.
Before we go on, would you go back to slide 10? In previous presentations, the P10 is the high price. You know, and in here, we have the P10 as the low price and a 90% probability of having the higher prices. So is this just a mistake in the graph, or is this a reversion of saying we're going to have 90% probability of it being below that?
I think, and I'll let Dan talk about it, I think that there's a little bit of a difference between the way we describe it and the way DNR. Our statement, our belief is that we have a 90% confidence that the price will be this or less, and so it makes sense. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure. For the record, again, Dan Stickle. So in typical statistical analysis, the P10 is usually the low end of the range, and the P90 is usually the high end of the range. The oil industry actually tends to do things a little bit differently. When you're looking at a production estimate from an oil company, they will look at the low end of the range as being the P90, which is the 90% chance of occurring. So I think what we've done here is we've just used the traditional statistical P10 and P90 versus the oil industry P10 and P90.
As we go forward, would you make sure that on the graphs you indicate,
yes,
label those, so when we got P90s, yes, and P10s?
Absolutely, and apologies for the confusion on that.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Guerra?
Thank you. Commissioner, so I've bitten my lip on this issue for years, but you know, I use the example of 2007, 2010. Oil was $120 a barrel, then it was $35 a barrel, and nobody ever predicted that. You know, you could use your best arguments, and they always sound good, but at some point, predictions are nice, but would your advice to us be to sort of be cautious about predictions in devising a fiscal plan? I mean, it's to nobody's fault, they're always wrong, almost always wrong. It's nobody's fault, but number one, it frustrates me to hear the greatest arguments for why it's going to be $70 a barrel next year, right? Because shale oil will make sure that oil is always going to be $70 a barrel. But in analyzing this, I mean, for the usefulness for us, is it smarter for us, or is it smart at all for us to sort of be very cautious about price estimates and try and build a fiscal plan around cautious price estimates?
Through the chair, I think that the department shares your sense that it's more important to be cautious and conservative. And in fact, we have received feedback from analysts on Wall Street, particularly the credit rating agencies, that they appreciate that the state has historically had a conservative view to pricing. And so I think we try to be fair and in the range, but not to, you know, chase a high price that may look like, you know, good times are coming, but in fact may not pan out. But to that spirit, I guess I would say that I do want to caution people to assume that the current pricing regime will remain over the long term. These slides, slide 12, if I can go there, in particular, just as an example, suggests that most analysts, the smartest people that are thinking about this, tend to believe that pricing will be in the $60 range, which is a little bit higher than where we're at, but not dramatically higher than the forecast that's here. I was reading this morning, EIA has issued their expectation is that for FY19 pricing will be $60, and for FY20 it'll be $61. So, again, within a few dollars of our forecast and meaningfully below the $70 forecast or the $70 pricing that's in the market today. So, I agree with you 100% that forecasts are never going to be right, precise, and our hope is that we can be close enough that it reflects a meaningful budget for decision and policymakers like you all to rely upon.
Thanks.
All right, if there are no further questions, we'll turn it over to Dan Stickle to carry on.
Sure. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to start with slide 14. So the state of Alaska, when doing our revenue forecasting, we look at three different types of costs. Company expenditures. We look at transportation costs, which are deducted in determining the gross value of the oil for both production tax and royalty. And then we also look at lease expenditures, the direct operating and capital expenditures incurred in exploring for and producing oil. So this first chart looks at what's going on with capital expenditures on the North Slope. We have had as a response to the lower prices over the last few years, we've had a pretty substantial decrease in company spending. And you see that capital expenditures on the North Slope are now below $2 billion in fiscal year 17 and 18. And so this chart compares in the blue line the current fall forecast to the orange line, which is the spring forecast. And what we're seeing is that capital expenditures have been cut for the next couple of years compared to the previous forecast, but then you see a bump out here in the 2020, 2021, and beyond range. And what that represents is some of these new fields that got added to the forecast beginning with this fall forecast. So this is the Pickas, the Willows, the Smith Bays, some of those new developments that we're starting to see, at least on a partial basis, coming into the forecast. They start to increase the expectation of capital expenditures there.
Does that include Point Thompson and AKA LNG?
Mr. Chairman, Point Thompson for the current development is in the forecast. DNR has a risked partial inclusion of an expansion to Point Thompson. No expenditures for AKLNG are included in the forecast. So at this point in time, our entire revenue forecast is based on oil only.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So 2017, those are still forecasts. Those aren't actual numbers.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the fall 2017 number here is our preliminary actual, and then we're comparing that to what the spring forecast was.
Okay. And follow up?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So why does it, you just pointed out, where it looks like there's going to be more activity going on. Why was it fall of 2017 for so many years and all of a sudden it's in the spring instead? Are they doing different types of activities? Because it, first of all, in 2017, you have more things going on in the spring than the fall. And in 2018 and 2019, then 2020, all of a sudden, now the larger numbers are all in the fall. Is that different fields, and that's why they're doing it at different times?
Yeah, Representative Wilson, and I probably should have clarified this a little bit more, but what this chart represents is the spring 2017 line represents the spring forecast for each full fiscal year. So, for example, when we issued the spring 2017 forecast last April, we were anticipating $2.5 billion of North Slope capital expenditures in fiscal year 18. And that was based on information that we received primarily from the operators themselves as well as other public information. Now, when we've issued the fall revenue forecast for that same fiscal year of 2018, we are now projecting $1.8 billion of capital spending, again, for the entire fiscal year 2018.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
I didn't get that at all. I'm sorry. So I guess what will change is when you get to 20, as you see the numbers flip, 2020 may actually not be like that once the numbers come in. So basically one's just updating the other, but it's all still the same fiscal year.
That's correct.
So in my mind, I'm splitting up spring and fall. And what you're just telling me is the numbers just change in the spring and the fall, but still means the entire, 2017 year. So really, it's not like doing work in the spring or the fall. It's just the updates are happening at that time.
This is Sheldon Fisher, the commissioner. Yeah, I think that's right. In other words, it's a little bit confusing. The numbers represent annual periods. And what's happening when you see the fall, the blue line go above the orange line, it's that we're now beginning to predict that they're going to start to invest more in these fields. This is driven partly by the rebound in oil pricing. We're now expecting, okay, in these out years in 2020 and 2021, we're now expecting that they're going to invest more than we were in the spring of 17 what we predicted at that time. And so it's we're updating our forecast of how their spending is going to how the kind of spending they're going to incur because of changes in market condition.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
This might make it easier, but I'm not adding the two figures together.
No.
Thank you.
And I believe that what we could have is bars representing the years, so it's not looking like it's changing over the from the start of the year through the end of the year. The expenditure is the estimate for the entire year. So if we had a series of bars, that would take away that implication that there's a change over in expenditure during the year, and you're not representing that at all with this. Is that correct?
That's
okay. Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about building these numbers and the expenditures, trying to figure out what information you're using to build that. Are you using DNR's production plans or the plans that they're given? Are you using press releases? Are you leasing annual reports or quarterly reports or just articles out of the Wall Street Journal or somewhere? So where are you building your projections out of?
Sure, and this is Dan Stickel again for the record. Representative Guttenberg to the chair. The answer is we're really using all of the above. The primary source of our expenditure estimates is once for each forecast, for the fall forecast and the spring forecast, we have a return submitted in our online revenue system that each of the operators submits. And what they do is they give us a five-year outlook for operating costs and capital costs for each of the units that they operate. So that's kind of the main basis of the expenditure forecasts. We also look at company presentations and news articles and things like that to kind of flesh out the remainder of the units. And then for some of these new units, you know, the Pica, Willow would be two really good examples, units like that, where DNR is applied a risk factor. We apply that same risk factor to the associated costs. But the main source of this information is the information that we get directly from the operators.
Okay. I'm sorry, just clarification.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first I heard you said everything, and now you're saying maybe I'm delineating it out or trying to make just like I think you should take everything everywhere and figure it out, and some things have more value than others. But with all of that world, how accurate are you? I mean, there's some people in the building that think everything that the industry does is based upon every word that we say. And that isn't factual, or we're not that important in the whole scheme of worldwide development. But how accurate have you been with all that information that's available in your predictions? Because this builds our budget. You know, a couple hundred million bucks one way or another is pretty significant for us.
Sure. Representative Guttenberg through the chair. Cost forecasting is challenging. There's two pieces. First, similar to production forecasting, there's the question of what are the companies going to actually do? And, you know, we had a few years where companies did a little bit less than they thought they were going to. And then we've had other years where they've ended up figuring out how to do a little bit more. The other piece is the overall cost of doing business. Cost inflation, we had several years of some pretty extreme cost inflation. And then the last couple years, there's been cost deflation to some extent, where the companies have been very aggressive in reducing their costs to make operations in Alaska work at a lower price level.
Inaccuracy, if I may.
In these cost forecasts, is this gross cost? In other words, it's not considering tax credits or writing off expenditures against a 35% profit tax or any. This is the gross cost of that is being expended, not who expends it. Field.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. And how much of the increase here in the blue line would be attributable to the Point Thompson expansion?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a relatively small contribution to the increase here. I think some of the other new new developments are more significant. The
don't see any other questions.
So moving on now to slide 15, this is a similar chart looking at operating expenditures as opposed to capital expenditures. What you see here is relative to the spring forecast, there's been an across-the-board downward shift in expected operating expenditures, even with the higher levels of production. And what this really represents is some of the efforts that the companies have made to reduce the cost structure in Alaska. And that's the case through about 2021, and then you see in 2022 and 2023, we've actually increased the overall operating cost estimate versus the previous forecast. And what that represents is some of these new fields coming online. So you have two dynamics. You have a reduction in the cost of existing fields, and then you have additional costs coming on for some of the new fields that have been added to the forecast.
I guess the question is, down at the bottom you have a note, and what's the purpose of that note?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, so the note says these estimates include lease expenditures by companies that are not expected to have a tax liability. And so we included that note just for clarity. Sometimes we will publish numbers for spending that represent only those costs that actually get deducted from a tax calculation, and that will be a little bit lower number than what's shown here. What's shown here represents all companies, regardless of whether they're making enough money to owe tax or whether they're an explorer who may not have a tax liability yet.
Sure. Thank you.
Then moving on to slide 16, this is the third type of cost, which is transportation costs. The biggest piece of transportation costs to get North Slope oil to market is, of course, the cost of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. This also includes feeder pipeline costs, marine costs, things like that. And what you see is in the spring forecast, we were projecting a pretty dramatic increase in transportation costs from a little over $9 a barrel up to over $14 a barrel over the 10-year time horizon. And currently in the fall forecast, we are expecting a much more gradual increase in transportation costs. This primarily represents the impact of higher production in the Trans-Alaska pipeline. You have a roughly similar cost of maintaining the pipeline infrastructure. You're now dividing that over a larger number of barrels, so the per barrel cost of that transportation comes down a little bit, which is a benefit to everyone on the it's a benefit to royalty and production tax as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
If I may, how much of this is calculated using the settlement agreement that the state had with the producers over the tariffs?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, this, if you're referring to the recently announced settlement in the last month or so, these transportation costs were calculated prior to announcing that settlement.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, so just off the top of your head, what would it look like post those settlements?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we'll have to get back to you with an estimate of that.
Thank you.
Sure. So moving on to slide 17, the next piece that I'll talk about is tax credits. So the legislature has taken action over the past couple sessions to phase out the programs for tax credits that can be funded by the state in cash. However, we anticipate that at the end of FY18, there will still be about $1 billion of these tax credits outstanding. Now, the revenue forecast assumes that $100 million of those are transferred to the majors to offset tax liability. That still leaves $900 million of outstanding tax credits eligible for state purchase going into FY19. And so, in statute, in the production tax under AS 4355.028, there is a statutory formula that provides guidance onto what the appropriation may be to help fund some of these credits. So we've included two slides here. Slide 18 is the spring 2017 forecast estimate of that statutory appropriation, and then the following slide will be the current calculation. As you can see, when we issued the spring forecast, we had about $8.4 billion in market value for North Slope oil, minus transportation costs and lease expenditures, giving a production tax value of $1.4 billion. And the tax on that would be about $490 million. Now, the statutory guidance when Alaska North Slope prices are $60 or higher provides that the appropriation is 10% of the revenue collected under the production tax statutes, which under the spring forecast would give a statutory appropriation of about $49 million. Moving on to slide 19 is the current calculation. Relative to the previous forecast, our price came down. Our price forecast came down a little bit, but that was more than offset by increased production forecast. We also had lower lease expenditures in the revised forecast versus the spring forecast. The net result of that is that the production tax value on the slope is now expected to be about $3.5 billion for fiscal year 19, giving a 35% net tax of between $1.2 and $1.3 billion. And the statutory appropriation language states that when the ANS price forecast is less than $60, we take 15% of that tax levied, which would give an appropriation of about $190 million. There's some Cook Inlet stuff that gets added to this, brings the official forecast up to $206 million. And should mention that when we do this calculation of the 35% tax, we are looking at the tax before application of credits. So the per barrel, when you adjust for the per barrel and the minimum tax, you actually end up with a lower number than that 1.2 that gets paid. But so these two slides just help explain where that statutory appropriation number comes from and why it's higher than it was in the previous forecast.
And before we go on, there are two interpretations of that statute. The only legislative history on that we've been able to find is that when it was introduced by Governor Parnell, he actually said the amount received by the state would be there, and since we don't receive that amount by the state, then that calculation would be after tax credits are applied, not before. Do you have any statutory or legislative history that makes you select a pre-tax liability instead of the actual amount that's received by the state in production tax?
Mr. Chairman, I'll maybe take this. This is Sheldon Fisher again. I think that we have heard that there's this question about what is the appropriate interpretation. And I guess we believe that the structure of the statute and the way it's written, and I'd like to come back with more detail around that. I'm probably not prepared to walk through the section by section analysis that leads to that conclusion. But I do feel I guess two thoughts. First of all, we believe that our that the way we've applied it here is correct, and we also believe that there is a history at this point. So there has been legislative debates on this topic that assumed that you would apply it to the gross. The governor's budget assumed the gross. We've published it for a couple of years now in the revenue source book as the gross. I don't think that means that you make a that you do the wrong thing just because you've done it that way in the past. But I do feel like that it's important that when the state takes a position and articulates that to the community and people behave in a particular way, that it's important to maintain some consistency. And as I say, I think as we walk through the statute and the structure of the statute, the way the sections refer to each other, it's our belief that that this interpretation of in this case 15% of the gross tax is the appropriate statutory interpretation.
And we'll probably have some more debate on this later, but I just wanted to make sure that while we were talking about this, we brought up that there is legislative history and there is introductory history on the statutory provision. So, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just so I can understand the chart, you're expecting that you're expecting $320 million in production taxes for fiscal year 2019. Is that what the bottom line means?
Yeah. Again, Dan Stickle for the record, Representative Guerra through the chair. This is an illustration of the tax calculation, so that's not precisely the forecast, but roughly speaking, yes.
And then I'm going to let this go, but I think people only do this to make my head explode because there is no 35% tax. It's at $160 a barrel, it's 35% profits, and that prices below $160 a barrel, it's a smaller percentage of profits. That's the per barrel credit. But I will be one who always can't stand seeing this 35% tax rate listed that doesn't exist. So.
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. Moving on to slide 20. So using the interpretation of the statute that we have been using and published here, this slide looks at what are the key changes from spring to fall. So the production forecast increased quite significantly. We have 29 million more taxable barrels in the FY19 forecast, which adds about $1 billion of gross value. The cost forecast decrease, this is the company's cutting back in response to the lower prices, that added about $1.1 billion to the production tax value. So you had about $2.1 billion more profit on the North Slope, which multiplied times the statutory tax rate of 35% gives you the $750 million of additional tax. And again, this is before application of those per barrel tax credits, as Representative Guerra mentioned. We also have a different statutory appropriation multiplier. The guidance language and statute allows for 15% of the tax before credits when the price forecast is less than $60 for this credit appropriation, and then 10% when the price forecast is 60 or higher. And so when we did the spring forecast, we were forecasting 60 for FY19, and the current forecast is $57. So you went from the 10% multiplier to the 15% multiplier. And so it was the combination of the higher production, the lower costs, and then the different multiplier that resulted in a significantly higher calculation for the statutory credit appropriation. Moving on to slide 21, this is an interesting chart which shows the credits that have been repurchased by the state each year in the gray bar, as well for 17 and 18. The 18 credits have been made, as well as a projection for 19 on based on this statutory appropriation that we just covered. And then in the blue bars is the ending balance of outstanding tax credits available for purchase at the end of the fiscal year. So for fiscal year 18, the state repurchased $78 million of tax credits. And at the end of the fiscal year 18, we'll have a little over $700 million outstanding. For fiscal year 19, we are estimating the statutory appropriation of $206 million. There are some credits that become payable in 2019. But then, assuming that statutory appropriation, there will be a little over $600 million outstanding at the end of fiscal year 19. And then as we proceed through the following years, if the statutory appropriation is made according to the calculation, we would exhaust all of these outstanding tax credits by fiscal year 2024.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And sorry for my lack of understanding here, but I thought in a previous slide, not that far back, you started your discussion by saying we had outstanding of $1 billion of tax credits, and then this says $700 million. So can you explain that?
Right. Representative Ortiz, through the chair. So the $1 billion represents our estimate of roughly the entire future liability of these outstanding tax credits. The forecast assumes that $100 million of those are transferred to the majors and applied against liabilities, which leaves about $900 million of credits that would be eligible for state purchase. And 700 of that 900 are available at the end of FY18. The remaining $200 million trickle in fiscal year 19-20. So those are not all payable now. Some of them are kind of in the system.
Okay, thank you.
And before we go on, can we go back to slide 19? Just so we get an explanation. So if we're looking at $57 a barrel and we are going down the total amount that we're receiving in the right-hand column, if you go down there to the tax, per barrel tax credits are applied, and so there's zero tax payment. And so if we didn't have the minimum gross tax of 4%, we would receive zero tax from all the oil produced on the North Slope. And there would still be, under your calculations, $190 million the state would owe to the company?
Mr. Chair, that's correct for production tax. If there was no minimum tax, per barrel credits at $57 a barrel would wipe out the production tax liability. We'd still receive corporate tax, property tax, royalty.
So there would be zero production tax that the state would receive with no minimum gross tax. And the calculation with the interpretation that the Department of Revenue is coming forward, we would owe $190 million to the oil companies. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I was interpreting that slide in the calculation methodology that the department would use.
Am I doing this part?
No.
I'm doing this part.
Representative Garrett?
Thanks. Mr. Stickle, just so I understand, based on your forecast of production tax revenue we'll receive in FY19 and your forecast of the statutory payment that would be due for prior tax credits, what is the net of what we'll have left over again that the state will get?
Sure. Representative Garrett, for FY19, we are forecasting $206 million statutory appropriation. And then our official forecast of production tax for FY19 is $339 million. So it's about a $130 million difference.
Thanks.
This is Sheldon Fisher again. If there are no further questions, this is our last section. We just wanted to review some changes to this forecast compared to prior forecast, and then the last slide I think gives a nice overall comparison. We'll talk about some of the components, and then the overall comparison will be the final slide. I'm on page 23, looking just at production tax revenue, some of the changes that have occurred from prior forecasts. Our oil price forecast, we declined slightly compared to the spring forecast. So in the spring, we thought during FY19 that the price of oil would be $60, and in this most recent forecast, it's $57. We've already talked a little bit about the production has stabilized versus where we thought it would be declining. The result is for production tax, this forecast, not the result of those first two changes, but in addition, the production tax revenue forecast in this presentation compared to the preliminary fall forecast is greater by about $173 million. Part of that was, again, even between the preliminary fall forecast and now we have increased our expectation of the price per barrel, but we also had a unexpectedly large number of companies come in and a larger than expected tax payments were actually received. We've talked a little bit about lease expenditures and how they're expected to fluctuate as a result of new production coming in, as well as company costs. And then finally, underlying all of this, and I just want to highlight, and I think we'll have, as you know, we have proposed a structure to repurchase the oil tax credits in a way that we think is fair to everyone. It is cost neutral, meaning that the cost of the financing will be borne by the companies because of a discount to the credits. And I think that this last bullet point about the instability and uncertainty, that is the issue that I think is important to try to address, and we hear it frequently, not just from the oil companies, but from many of the financial investors that I think are critical to our state as we see development going forward.
And Representative Ortiz and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I try to be as concrete as possible for myself here to understand all this stuff. And is it safe to say that based on your FY 2018 line there that says production tax revenue forecast increased from preliminary forecast by $173 million, is it safe to say then that in order for our state to meet its obligations for its fiscal year 2018 budget, that we'll be having $173 million more to put towards those obligations, and so therefore there would be $173 million less of a draw on other sources of money. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I'm going to jump forward I'll get to this again, but this is the very last slide, and that middle set of columns there is the final fall forecast. You see for FY18, the unrestricted revenue is just over $2 billion. It's $2.082 billion. That represents a 200 overall. So the prior slide we were talking about was just production tax. This is from all sources for FY18. We predict you will have $248 million more in unrestricted general fund revenue, which all things being equal would be $248 million less that you would have to draw from other sources.
The CBR or something like
that.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last bullet is something we all should be concerned about. And I think it was a December or maybe December Resources Committee where they had a presentation on the AK LNG project. And I, Mr. Myers made a comment about the Chinese outlook on investing in Alaska, and he had a completely different focus from the Chinese on this perspective. And I asked him to elaborate on that, and he would pretty – and I have a written statement from him, and what he said was the Chinese appreciated the stability of our tax regime and the certainty of it in the context of recognizing that we are a democracy and things change, but that was a factor in one of the reasons why they were looking to us in a positive way. So I will get you a copy of that and we can distribute that, but I think it, you know, people that are impacted us on day to day have always want a better regime. They always want a better break. They're always complaining about the taxes. But I think that overall picture in the world that Alaska's investment climate, we don't have dictatorships take over one year to the next. We don't pull executives off of oil rigs. We don't hold them hostage. You know, we try to do the best thing we can, and just like they do, we try to get the best tax regime we can in that world. And I don't consider that instability or uncertainty, because they're doing the same thing from the other side. We are partners with them, and we're always negotiating for the best thing we can. And if the Chinese look at it a different way than others do, I think we just need to point that out.
Through the chair, I think that's a fair point. And so let me maybe give a slightly different perspective, or maybe it's the same perspective from a slightly different vantage point. I was on the call with a bank today that he gave the example that they had lent into Alaska under a set of assumptions about the way the oil tax credits would be treated. And we can all talk about whether or not their assumptions were appropriate or not, but he had gone to his credit committee about and made certain representations about Alaska, and his statement was that he would be uncomfortable to go back to that same credit committee with the current environment and try to, you know, approve a future loan for a business, whether it's in the oil and gas industry or some other industry, because of questions that he anticipated he would receive about this topic. Now, he also offered that he'd gotten a call recently about investing in Venezuela, and he said he absolutely, you know, he's not going to Venezuela. And so I don't disagree with you that it depends on the filter you want to apply. There's no question that Alaska, as part of the United States, being part of the regime that we have, the stability that we have, and there's tremendous benefits to Alaska. And I'm not trying to suggest anything different compared to many regimes in the world. But I do think that we should be cognizant and careful about the way we make changes, because other people are relying on those changes, or relying on the statements that we have made, and they are impacted by the changes, and that will impact their behavior in the future.
We don't have to debate the point, but that's fine.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I'm on slide 24, and I'm going to go through these relatively quickly. I would just offer them to you for your consideration. It just highlights, I think, a lot of the things that we've talked about. This is, again, on the left-hand side, it reflects changes in terms of between this final fall forecast and the preliminary fall forecast. On the right-hand side, it is showing the changes between the final fall forecast and the spring forecast that we had. And you can see it's prices, production, lease expenditures, transportation costs, and ultimately revenue. And again, this is oil petroleum revenue. And then in slide 25, showing the, forgive me, slide 24 was fiscal year 18, slide 25 is fiscal year 19. Similar changes between, you can see the differences in that we've talked about in terms of oil price and production and the various aspects as well. This is, we hope, a helpful slide for you. It allows people to understand how changes in oil price impact predictions around general fund revenue. What you see is that, in fact, it's not a flat curve. As companies hit a break point where they begin to pay above the minimum tax, then the value of each additional dollar of revenue that the state receives for each additional dollar of a barrel of oil changes. And so in the $50 to $60 range, it's somewhere between $30 and $40 million. When you get above $65, it actually becomes closer to $70 million of additional revenue for the state for each dollar per barrel. But this is a chart that people can refer to if they have questions and want to kind of understand how that impact changes.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Just quickly, just back on 25, I just want to make sure. So on the 1.4 that you have under the final fall forecast, that's all taxes, all monies that come in because of oil, correct?
Yes, this is general fund unrestricted petroleum revenue.
So So the only part that wouldn't be included primarily is what we put away to pay currently for oil tax credits. Are there other pots of money that it wouldn't go into besides the permanent fund?
Well, so this doesn't include the money that the royalties that are deposited in the permanent fund. That would not be included. I'm going to ask Dan what else give us a list of what else might not be included.
Sure. Again, Dan Zatekel for the record, Representative Wilson through the chair. The restricted petroleum revenues that are not included here is going to be the portion of royalties that go to the permanent fund and also the 0.5% of royalties that go to the school fund. Those are by constitution. Any deposits to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund that are made for settlements or termination of litigation, as well as any payments from the federal government for the national sharing of royalties in the NPRA.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, we don't keep most of the property tax. We give that to municipalities. So is property tax that we end up not keeping in that $1.4 billion figure or no?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, the $1.4 billion includes the state's share of property tax, which is a little over $100 million. We allow a credit for municipal taxes paid. We don't actually share that money directly with them. But, yeah, it's around half a billion dollars in total property tax. And then the state keeps a little over $100 million of that.
Thank you. Through the chair.
So just
a rough estimate of that $1.4 billion, for about $1.2 billion of it is the royalty. Is that a close estimate?
Representative Gareth, through the chair, we actually have a chart on page 26 of the revenue sources
book. Good enough for me. I'll look at it.
Yeah. It has all the detail behind this number.
Would you explain that one more time about the property tax? So what is included in that number, the $500 million or $100 million?
Mr. Chairman, the fall forecast here includes, looking at fiscal year 19, $110.8 million in state property tax. And then our estimate of the gross tax statewide for oil and gas property is $567 million. This is looking at FY17. So in FY17, $567 million statewide, $443 million of that went to the municipalities, and we allow that municipal payment as a credit against the state tax. So our net state tax was a little over $120 million.
That. And so only the net amount is shown in the unrestricted petroleum revenue in the bottom line.
Correct.
This,
Reverend Guttenberg.
On that, again, what will this look post TAP settlement with property tax and everything else included? Would you get back with me like you will the other one? That's fine.
Yes.
I don't change it that much. I think so. That's the issue.
These last few slides, then, we'll similarly kind of try to flag the total revenue forecast, and it includes other revenue beyond just the oil revenue that we've been talking about. And so on slide 28, you can see that the, as we've discussed, we are forecasting that the total unrestricted revenue will increase from FY17 of about $1.35 billion to just over $2 billion, and that will stay relatively constant in 19. I won't go through all the numbers. At the bottom line, you see the total state revenue appears to be declining. Most of that decline is associated with investment revenue. We had a great year in FY18, this forecast assumes a more traditional assumption around return on our investment income. Moving on then to.
Let me back up. It says 6.95, so that means you have not yet adopted. You haven't adopted the same actuarial return 6.5 that the permanent fund has.
No, this is based on 6.95 at this stage.
Thank you.
Then on, on slide 29. This just provides additional information about petroleum corporate income tax as well as royalties and rents in other categories in detail, historical detail. And then slide 30 is the non-petroleum revenue and gives you that detail as well.
Before we go there, would you go back to slide 29?
Sure.
On petroleum corporate income tax in 17, actual history, that's what is that minus 59.4?
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record. Mr. Chairman, as a result of the decrease in oil price in a few years ago, we had some pretty large refunds, as well as there's a provision in the corporate tax code that allows companies to carry back a loss to prior years. And so the combination of those two things resulted in net refunds paid out for petroleum corporate tax in fiscal year 16 and 17. So far in fiscal year 18, we're seeing that payments are actually positive. And with the recovery in price, we're expecting a return to positive payments in 18 and beyond.
And when we say refunds or positive payments, does that mean only a negative if there's money that they have paid, or is that kind of like credit?
No, Mr. Chairman. So. Every year we receive payments from the companies, and then every year we pay out some amount of refunds, and these are refunds for overpayments in a prior year, similar to how you'd receive a refund on your federal income tax. It just so happened that in fiscal year 16 and 17, those refunds exceeded the current year payments. As companies that saw a loss in the current year with the low oil prices were able to carry back a portion of that loss to claim a refund for prior years. And I think in the long version of this presentation, or as a follow-up, we had a chart that broke that out into the various components, and we'd be happy to provide that again as well.
So I think this is our last slide, and it provides just a long-term view. We touched on it very briefly earlier. You can see the total UGF for FY18 is predicted to be just under $2.1 billion and staying relatively flat in that range going forward, and then in the out years growing. And in particular, compared to the spring forecast, were FY18 is about $250 million more. FY19 is about $127 million. I won't read it all, but as you can see, compared to the spring forecast where we thought we were later this year, there's meaningfully more expectation of revenue in the coming years, which is positive. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
You don't have to go back to the chart, but we are expected to receive about $173 million more in production tax revenue than was forecasted earlier. But we also have been sort of sticking to the statutory formula for paying out tax credits. With the change in prices or production, is the amount going out adjusted also? So when it turned out we expect to get $173 million more in production tax revenue, is there also a higher payout going back the other way for the statutory credit payment?
Through the chair, yes. In other words, as Dan, well, actually, it's worth going back, I think, to the chart.
So it's not a net 173 if we stick with the statutory tax credit, right?
Well, I think that's right, yes, and if that's your question. Well, I guess I'd have to make sure I do the math and get that precise answer. So let us come back to you on that.
Thanks.
While we're on this slide, while we're on 19, just trying to look at $57 per barrel, what this says is there, under the current profit tax regime, there would be zero tax paid, and the gross minimum tax of 4% is less than $2 per barrel. $1.89 per barrel is the total production tax that we would receive per barrel. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what is the royalty on each barrel?
That varies by field, but I'll let Dan try to summarize it if we can.
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. Representative Wilson through the chair. The royalty, I think the average royalty on the North Slope that the state gets is in the range of about 12%. Most of the legacy leases are at the 12.5% rate. There's some that are higher, some that are lower.
Thank you.
And that's based on the production tax value?
Mr. Chairman, the royalty is based on the gross value, which is going to be, so the royalty is going to be based roughly on that $47.14 number. And at current price levels, royalty is absolutely the largest component of our oil revenue.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to follow up on the question that Representative Vergara asked regarding production tax increase. Slide 23 says, we've mentioned it several times, there was an increase of $173 million from the forecast. That's the difference between the spring forecast and fall forecast, correct?
Representative Grant, through the chair, the 173 is the difference between the preliminary fall and the final fall for FY18.
Thank you. And then what was the difference in the increase of production tax credits now due from the preliminary to the final?
It would be just a few million dollars. I don't think there
was a small increase.
It was a small increase, yeah.
Okay.
Seeing none, thank you very much for the presentation today. Any correspondence, Mr. Commissioner, for questions that were proposed today, you can either send them to me or address them to house.finance.legislation@aka.gov and I'll distribute those to all committee members. And our next meeting is Monday, January 22nd at 1:30. We'll have at that time a presentation on the Alaska Permanent Fund. Any further questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we're going to be going through departments, is there a deadline when we should be able to find those on basis? Is it 24 hours or an hour before we get here? Because it would just be nice to know when to start looking for the presentations for the next day so that we could be better prepared.
Yeah, those are published now.
But, I mean, how soon? I mean, have you as a chairman made it so that it would be like that morning or the day before? Is there something that the departments know or that the commissioner here would have known that for today's presentation, you want it so that it could be up by 5 o'clock, or so we're not just continuously looking, trying to find it?
Right. I will talk with the agency and find out. Sometimes they're doing them up until the last, but we'll take a brief of these. Back on the record, yes, my office requested all the agencies to have their presentations to us by noon on the day before. The secretary has said that she normally has them by 1, and we'll just have a further sent an email notice to everybody when those are available.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Are there any other questions or anything else come for the committee at this time? Seeing none, we will be adjourned.